It's harder than you realize. So understand, you will learn at the elite level from failing. Which environment are you going to recover from failure or fail into improvement from? What coach resonates with you in terms of how to get you to the next level? As you experience your time on these campuses and spend time, who do you want to be surrounded with? Because you will fail. So understand that. And then who do you want to be around when it gets tough?
All right, every week to start the show, we'll be opening up with our tip-off segments. This segment is going to be covering something unique and exciting. We're going to be looking at different perspective on topics that aren't your vanilla hoops concepts. So let's jump right on in for episode 2. Having coached at different levels throughout my coaching career, I feel like I have a different lens to look through and look back on as I think about things that I tried and things that worked at different levels. I think things are such age and stage appropriate. And a lot of times as we are looking at and thinking about plays, culture, whatever it may be, we don't really consider that piece as much as just what the thing is. We have a lot of high school coaches and college coaches tuning in. So I thought this would be a great topic to kind of talk about things that are universal for all levels, and then what might be a little more level specific as we get into things from the tactical side. So the X's and O's, the basketball implementation, all of those things. I think it's so easy to watch a game, see something work. Maybe you're watching the NCAA tournament, somebody gets a wide open layup, and you're like, man, that's got to be really good. I know that because that's the thought I have every time I see it. And so we go and we want to steal those things. And I think one thing, especially earlier in my career, I didn't really consider that much was, why did they get so open? I mean, I saw the play. I could easily write it down, go out there. And then for some reason, I didn't think of, maybe it was our timing. Maybe it was this, maybe it was that. But what I really wasn't considering was, why did it work? And so many of the whys could have easily been chalked up to, well, it was what the other team was doing to them, which is why it worked. As a high school coach, I was really guilty of getting on YouTube, Googling best zone sets of the NCAA tournament or best zone sets of college basketball, whatever year it was, and just wanting to steal those. And, you know, one thing that I have found is vastly different is high school zones and college zones are played so differently that if you really don't look at the why of why a play is working, you can find yourself putting in a bunch of stuff that's not going to work. In college, most of the zones are pretty high and wide. I mean, they're really extended out. Those bottom outside guys of 2-3 zones are really getting out to cover corners. And it's leaving that soft spot in those short corners, block areas, a lot more open than they tend to be in high school. And so when you're looking at zone plays, the zone plays for twos, a lot of times, almost all the time, revolve around pulling those bottom outside guys out. Well, in college, it's not all that hard. And so you find some good duck in plays and some short corner slip stuff, and you can find some of those really good lob plays on the backside against zones that, that may not be as effective. On the flip side, those plays that you see in college that are usually getting, you know, open threes against zone, you can probably get even more open than they get because those shots are just easier to find based on how those things are played. And so, you know, you just have to consider when you're looking through all this stuff, you know, why things are working. Is this going to work? Is this going to work for me at my level? And things like that. Even consider the drills you're doing. Okay, great example. 2014, I go to a coaching clinic in Ohio, watch Gary Waters, former men's coach at Cleveland State, practice, had a full open practice. And I mean, he's coaching his butt off. He's got great juice. The managers are flying around. I mean, it's just a well-oiled machine. I'm watching him do a zigzag drill, and they're trying to get multiple turns on the ball handler. You know, they're a great pressure team, and they wanted to get those turns, and all that was awesome. And I'm like, this is basketball. I like this. So I stole it. Not only did I steal it, I called it Viking Zigzag. Loved it. I was like, I cannot wait to go home and run Viking zigzag drill with my team. So we did. We get back, you know, probably every third, fourth practice we're doing it, you know, and we ran the mess out of Viking zigzag that year, and we probably never zigged or zagged a soul all year because we played pack line, keep it in front of you. We would sit on your left hand, everybody, everywhere. And if you were getting zigged or zagged, you were just wrong. So I looked back as I got a little older and laughed and, you know, just thought like, man, I don't know what, but it looked cool. It, I mean, it looked really cool. And for them, it had a great purpose. But, you know, and this is for college coaches too. I went as a high school and former AAU coach, I went and watched a ton of college practices. And, you know, the best college practices I saw, if I never saw them in a full game, I could probably tell you with a reasonable degree what they were about offensively and defensively. Their shooting drills tied into their warm-up drills, tied into their skill drills. There's no phase of the practice that didn't tie into what they were all about. And how they did one thing is how they did everything. And on the flip side, I've been to plenty of practices where, you know, there were some, you know, maybe some rotate and rebound drills and, you know, they played zone the whole time. They played the zone the whole time, you know, and they, you know, probably never did zone rebounding drills. And so I just think that's one thing to really keep in mind. And you know, I've been such a, you know, that was probably the biggest mistakes I made when I first got into it was that piece of it. And it, there's no ill intent there. We just see good stuff and we want to take it and we want to do it. And, you know, but thinking, how does it all fit? How does it all tie? And I think the big eye-opening awakening moment that I first had came about 4 years, 3 or 4 years into my head coaching career. I asked a former D2 national championship level coach to come watch my practice. And I said, hey, give me an honest evaluation. I'm trying to get better. I want feedback. You know, watch practice. Tell me what you think. And we opened practice. You know, I was like, look, we got to bring the good stuff. You know, let's let her see what we're all about here. And so, you know, we're doing this high energy drill. Players are dribbling kind of in between a circle of guys that are hitting their arms, and you know that the energy's great and the tempo's great, and we're moving and everybody, coaches are getting after it, and you know I'm kind of like side-eyeing over there like, you seeing this? And she was seeing it, and she was not really having it, but we get through the practice, and I asked her after practice, I'm like, hey coach, you know, what'd you think? The first thing she said was, the first drill you did today might have been the dumbest thing I've ever seen in basketball. And that hurt, but it was really good feedback because she talked me through that. And she just said, you know, when in a game are you going to be dribbling through a circle of your teammates hitting your arms? And I was like, okay, probably never. So I just think there's – and there is value. You're never going to three-man weave either out there, but I think there's value in some of those things. Again, talking age and stage appropriate as we look at those drills and how they change and how we need to change and grow with them. And it's not just the X's and O's and the tactical side. It's also the philosophy side. Growing up in Indiana, Bob Knight was basketball. And, you know, how he went about his business was how he did it. And watching him, you know, just a fiery dude, you know, coaching 22-year-old, 21-year-old, you know, men, it didn't really register with me when I became a coach that I may not be dealing with those same people, because my high school coach was Bob Knight Jr. And I saw Bob Knight growing up and I thought that was the only way to do it. And I just thought that's how you coach basketball. Coming out of college, my first job was a freshman boys coach. So I am 23 years old, coaching a bunch of 14-year-old boys, and probably said some things and called them some things that I'd probably be selling insurance right now if I said it today. And so, but again, I never really had any kind of dialogue with anyone, or I never really had to think about my audience. And again, I go back to the age and stage thing, because in everything we do, whatever level we're at, I think that's so vital to making sure that, you know, you're zooming in and making sure that, you know, you're analyzing everything you do, because all of it matters. And so really zoom into what you're doing, to focus in on the today, when it comes to everything, and ask why. Ask why. All right, our guest today wears many hats in this profession. His fingerprints are all over the women's college basketball game and beyond. He helps drive Premier Basketball and the ESPNW Top 100 rankings. He's also a part of the McDonald's All-American Games Committee, and he was a successful Division I women's basketball assistant coach. This man needs no introduction, but we're super fortunate to have Shane Laughlin on the Coach's Playbook podcast. Shane, welcome to the Coach's Playbook podcast. Really appreciate you hopping on and spending some time talking a little basketball with us.
Appreciate you having me on. Great way to kind of segue into the weekend right before the season tips.
Yeah, it's an exciting time for all of us in this deal, kind of like our you know, like our Christmas Eve, so to speak, coming up. And, you know, I was excited to get you on as one of the first guests. You know, I feel like so many people know you for the spotlight you've brought as a ESPN women's recruiting analyst, and what you do with the rankings and with the McDonald's All-American stuff. And I think people would love to just kind of get to know who you are and not what you do. You know, speaking from personal experience, you know, being even on this side of it, you know, that's kind of what I knew you as. And then, you know, we're sitting in a gym in April, and you just kind of walk over, and I'm just sitting next to Gino or Emma, and I see you walk up to him, and, you know, you guys start talking shop, and you're talking in depth, in the weeds, ball screen coverage stuff. And, you know, I'm kind of laughing, thinking, man, this guy's a real deal. Who is he? And so I hit a quick Google and found out that, you know, you're not just a really cool Twitter guy. You're a basketball coach, a former recruiting coordinator. And so, yeah, man, dig in on your past and what got you to where you are today.
Sure. No, I appreciate it. You're giving me far too much credit. I don't know if I manage Twitter in a cool way anymore. That's up for the audience, I guess. And then in terms of our current platform, I mean, we certainly, you know, we inherited that and we took it over. We certainly didn't create it, and the people who create it deserve a lot of credit for that. And we're sitting in a good spot in the women's game. I appreciate those kind words, but definitely is in no way, shape, or form created or run just by me. But as far as getting here, the bullet points, I mean, just like probably most of our audience and you, just a lifelong hoop head, fall in love with the game early. You know, I remember, like, I like going to Nike TOC for a number of reasons, but every year it takes me home to the Phoenix area, and I literally go to the basketball court where I first shot my first shot at Estrada Park in Tempe. A good group of us got to go on one of the off days of TOC a couple years ago, just the way the tournament fell. We were able to hoop a little bit there. So, like, that's the essence of where love for the game started. And then in terms of the professional stuff, I was most fortunate to start as a graduate assistant for the legendary Jody Conrad at the University of Texas in her last 2 years of her career. And the staff that was there, and Jody, and the athletic department there, and everybody poured into me, gave me access, taught me things, gave me a foundation for understanding of the game at a much higher level, and grew from there, was able to become an assistant coach and recruiting coordinator at University of Texas Arlington under Samantha Morrow, and then after that, an assistant coach at Rice University, Greg Williams. And each one of those stops gave me a different view, a different look, a different understanding, different responsibilities, different growth opportunities, different challenges. I made different mistakes at all of them and did new things and accomplished new things at each one. And after Rice, segued through some other things, and then started with Premier Basketball with Joey Simmons and his crew. I started coaching a club team on the Adidas circuit at that time, started lending support and work to the events, took over the recruiting service, which Joey had started with his brother back in the day. Mark Williams and Jason Key had done a wonderful job with it. I was able to join the team, kind of manage it a different way in a kind of a full-time manner. We grew, expanded, and then in 2020 we became part of the Three Step Sports organization, and things really took off from there. And then that connected us with the opportunities at ESPN. And
I think it's cool to hear to hear people's stories and their path, and think one little subplot and a takeaway for everyone. As a former high school coach getting into the college side, that there's so many people that ask, how do you get to an X job, or how do you get this? And I just think, like you said, you put yourself out there. I mean, in enough places, you might accidentally get lucky. I mean, you need to be good, but you need to be lucky too. And opportunity knocks for everybody. The problem is it usually shows up wearing overalls and looks like work. And so I think it's cool to, like there's not one right path. I think the more, the more you're willing to put yourself out there and meet those people, and like you said, keep those networks, you just give yourself a chance. A big part of, a big part of launching this podcast was just, giving back to the game. It gave me everything. And I was a 21-year-old, I was 20 when I started. I was at a Division II school, and the co-head coaches there had just taken the job, and it gave a 20-year-old fraternity dude way more responsibility than I'd ever let go right. As a head coach.
Right.
But I never forgot that. And as I got older, that really, that really hit me in the head. Like, man, I'm here because people gave me a chance that I didn't even deserve, So I just love sharing what I can and helping everybody that, everybody that I can. So, big part of the reason to do this, through talking with you a little bit, leadership and leading young people is something that I can tell you're passionate about. And, it was, eye opening that, this isn't like just a business for you. I mean, this is a people thing for you. And, to hear you talk about, something you said was a big difference in the young folks today, compared to, maybe when we were coming up, is, you said the phrase, that these guys are living in a comparative environment, whereas we grew up in a competitive environment. So can you dig in on that a little bit, and also point out why that's not a bad thing? I hate to hear the phrase kids today, because we were kids today to our grandparents too. So go ahead and dig in on that.
Right. The elements of why we do what we do are important to me and our team. And it allows us to be patient and care about the game and take our stuff seriously. And so you pay attention to a lot of levels. We end up a hub between, the grassroots game and into the college game. And then once you're around enough, you've got some credibility and you're able to branch out a little bit and still learn from the professional ranks and now the business of basketball. And, the kind of observation or comment about the comparative versus competitive, I think some of that's, it's just due to the way they consume the game and watch it through, and again, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. Like you said, it's not a bad thing, but through like a social media, it puts you sometimes in a comparative situation because you're sitting with your phone in your hand or your computer in front of you or whatever, while you're watching somebody else do something, in action. And I think it puts you in a different spot without a perspective lens, right? And for young people, you need a lot of experience to have perspective. And so if their introduction to the game is kind of, that's what that person's doing, or they get a snippet, you can't directly apply that to your experience. And back, with us, we knew of people out there, but it was written or maybe a few video clips. You kind of had to use your imagination, but you certainly didn't have it just processed for you and give it to you constantly anytime you want it. So we had more of a small snapshot of what was going around us. And so you naturally just compete with the people around you. I do think today's group is competitive, but I do think there are layers of comparative stuff that can be a little bit of a drawback. And some of it is in the way that they're coached, the way the coaches process information and what's out there. And then some of it is just how they consume it. And I think sometimes, there can be the danger of skipping a few steps or misinterpretation in there. And I just think it's something that leaders should know, particularly when you're talking about development with young people, like taking them from, point A to point B to point C as a player, or growing them through their grassroots or into college. You've got to understand that's how they work. So meeting them where they are and understanding that's important, I think.
Yeah, and this is every level. We look at the top end guys, and you see, you know, comparing the top 15 players in the country. This is at a local level of, you know, people, especially young guys, as they're going through their recruitment process, they see someone gets an offer. And, you know, when I was coaching travel basketball, that was the first thing parents would come to me typically. And, well, how come so-and-so got an offer? And, you know, I think my daughter's, you know, just as good or whatever. And, you know, it was hard for them to run their own race. And sometimes they might not even be wrong. You know, I mean, from a talent right. standpoint or whatever, right. you know, but you're running, you know, you got to run your race. And so, and even down to, you get into any high school where there's, you know, a kid that's fighting for varsity and there's JV things. And, but that comparative piece of it can really steal the joy out of it. And a big thing that is crazy, and it's awesome for our game, the amount of people that are pouring, just, you know, it's crazy to me to think back, you know, 15, you know, years or so, where AU was, hey, the best two dudes from my county are playing the, you know, alongside the best two dudes from, you know, an hour down the road. And there was only a handful of teams, and it was truly those, you know, elite players. And now there's, you know, there's high school teams where they've got tons of JV kids that are playing travel basketball. Mm-hmm. Their parents are pouring money and time and skipping vacations and making all these sacrifices for their, you know, sons and daughters. And, you know, like, I think it gets easy to for parents to tie their identity into their kids and their kids' success and what they get out of it. And especially business-minded people who are like, what's the return on my investment here? And so I think all those things, you know, lend into, and like I said, it's great for a game that so many people are so excited about it, but then it also puts that pressure back on the kids. And like you said, they live on social media. I mean, that's where they're at, and that's not going away. And so we need to figure out how to plug into that, tap into that, and help, you know, there's a education piece of it. And there's also just a helping people settle into running their own race and being okay with where their feet are and okay, where do you want to get? Well, how do we get there? And don't worry about where so-and-so down the road's at.
Yeah, I agree. I think all of that, I think it's important. And a lot of factors that go into some of the things that you named, like timing of offers, recruitment to certain places, programs. And there's too many variables to just pinpoint it and make assumptions. So sometimes you just have to assess it. Your own situation and accept where you are and then control your controllables. And so, yeah, you've got to seek the education as best you can. Understand with the numbers in participation comes maybe some periphery participants that aren't equipped to explain everything. And it's quite okay. That's quite okay. But yeah, I think you bring up a really important foundational principle, which is like run your race. And then I would, you know, just add on to that, like you got to control your controllables and then be honest in your assessment and what you're doing. And then understand, like, you don't just play sports for a scholarship. And the fact is the majority of people do not, because that's not their end game, because it's not going to happen for them. And there are a lot of things that sports can do. There's nothing wrong with it being social in terms of, you know, a level of competitiveness, what it can teach you. But social and recreational, and there's nothing wrong with getting better in the summer so you can be a better contributor to a high school situation. But let's not confuse the two and saying, like, I've done X, Y, and Z that somebody else did. Therefore, those are the requisites that I checked off a box to be qualified, to be recruitable to a certain level.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's switch gears a little bit, still kind of in that leadership vein, but talking about accountability, you know, it's not just the age of the college transfer portal, although, you know, I think that's obviously on the forefront, you know, and the back and everywhere else of, you know, coaches' minds at the high school level, you know, transferring is rampant and it's a part of it. And again, that's another thing that's probably not going away or anytime soon. I think there's, you know, when we talk about accountability, can we hold young people accountable? I mean, should we? I mean, obviously, yes. What is, you know, but what's that sweet spot? You know, I think we're at a, you know, at an interesting kind of interpass of coaches where, you know, I think we've got a lot of old school, really tough, great coaches who are very much, that's my way or the highway, and I've done this a long time, I've won, and you're going to do it because I say so. And, you know, and then I think there's also a lot of people on the accountability spectrum that are scared to death to coach their best players. You know, they're just scared they're going to leave. And so they just don't, you know, they avoid the confrontation, they avoid, but that's needed. You know, you're not really setting them up for success in life after they play for you if there's zero degree of accountability, because at some point, and when it matters more, when the stakes are higher in their life, they're going to get held accountable for the first time, and they're not going to be able to handle that probably in the right way. And so what is that balance? And you know, especially, like I said, learning about young people today and the world they live in, what do we as coaches and leaders of young people need to be cognizant of, and how do we do that? You know, what's the best path to make sure we're doing them justice, you know, but also loving on them too?
Right. A good principle to start with is just understand that people come from different paths and different experiences. And as coaches right now, the societal environments and things, they change faster than they used to in terms of like generationally, right? And our players are, they function in a different society than we grew up in, or we understood 5 or even 5, 10 years ago. So I think understanding, as a coach, you've got to try to be familiar with, without participating in, because it'd be, you know, impossible. They're like, you got to be familiar with the environment that they're coming from or dealing with. And I think that's an important piece to understand. I think as a way to do that, you have to build relationships. You have to show players a little bit of vulnerability. You mentioned like the transfer, environment that we're in. I think it's developing, but you can't fight it. Like you said, it's not going away. I think the NCAA's decisions with their policies now with transfers is going to have a little bit of a trickle-down effect to high schools. I think we're seeing that. And as far as hands-on with the leadership, you know, patience and meeting the players where they are and understanding them. And like I said, being willing to teach and nurture and show vulnerability. You can't just be this authority figure. And newsflash, none of us are, right? We're vulnerable. We all made mistakes leading up to this point. You don't want to model mistakes to them, but you've got to show them, like, everything is a constant learning experience. And I think when they understand that and meet you there, they're willing to come with you as you want to bring them to their next place. And like, people do say like these players aren't as coachable or they don't want to be coached. And that is absolute nonsense. They're very fun to coach. They just may need a different teaching than what you had on your agenda bringing to the floor. And it's your job to adjust and assess and do it. And you can complain about it all you want, but I think, I got a really good experience through the Adidas EuroCamp a couple years ago with a great group of people. We were able to take 20 of the best players in the country, and then we were able to split up, come up with game plans, and compete through a 10-day period, and they soaked it up. And I never felt like at any given time during that time that they were uncoachable or didn't want to be coached. I felt the exact opposite. And that's just a small example, but I think that's indicative of our players.
Yeah. Somebody once told me, look at each kid and assume that they're doing the best with what they know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, that was powerful, you know, because you hold them to the standard of your life and your experiences. And man, that's tough. I mean, the kids are generally good. They generally want to be held accountable. It's just such an awful misconception to assume that and to hold them to a standard they don't, may not even know or understand. As a younger coach, I think I was 24, 25. I had a Hall of Fame coach give me some advice, and she said, never let them see you sweat, never let them see you cry. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, got it. And they got it. I'm going to be a tough, hard son buck, you know?
Yeah.
And, they didn't like that, you know,
right.
And it was impersonal, and it wasn't me. I loved them, and I did, and I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be on that level, but I thought, hey, this is what it is, and you said it, and that's the gospel, so
right.
That's what I did, but, you know, now I'm like, hey, here it is. Like, here's all the sweat. Like, we're wearing this thing together, guys.
Absolutely. To your point at the beginning, like, you understand they're doing the best with what they've got, and I had to learn that the hard way, and early on as a young coach, like, in real positions, like, I failed miserably at that aspect. Like, I'm competitive to my core. You can't lead with competitiveness all the time. And I had to learn that with staff dynamics. I had to learn that with dealing with different players. And, like, they always understood my passion, and they understood where it was coming from. The delivery was not fantastic. The expectation was not fair because I was not equipped to do it incrementally with them. I just expected them to want to walk on the floor and want it as bad as I did. And it doesn't mean they didn't. They just did it and expressed it or wanted it in a different way. And not knowing that it was my responsibility to nurture that out of them in, you know, maybe 15 different ways.
Well, before we get on to a different topic, I want to shout out Dr. Tim Elmore. If you are a parent, and, you know, let alone a basketball coach, he is somebody I think, you know, go check out. I mean, the amount of research and work and time he's spent into learning how to, like, lead and parent young people today. He's got some incredible books, Marching Off the Map, IY Generation. I mean, it is truly unbelievable. Talks a lot about, you know, preparing kids for the path and not the path for the kids, but just so many unique and gives practical ways. So if that's something you're interested in, I think that's a great resource to get better. Shane, you've got some invaluable insights into the recruiting world in a lot of different fronts and in a lot of different areas. And while we got you, I want to hit as much on that spectrum as we can. A big part of this podcast, we want to help coaches. We want to help kids too. You know, we want to help give some education, some insight, some light and advice for anybody that's wanting to get recruited or play, you know, college basketball or any college sport. I think this is a lot of this stuff is universally applicable. You know, the fact is there are over 28,000 women's college basketball players across all NCAA divisions, including JUCO. And I'm sure 95% of those, you know, or more thought at some point that they did or wanted to play Division I basketball. You know, how can someone who's, you know, at any step, how can they gauge where they're at? That was something you talked about was some honest self-assessment. Well, human beings, we ain't always the greatest at self-assessment. So where can I go? How can I gauge where I'm at and get some honest, you know, evaluation or understand where I'm at in what I'm doing?
Yeah, it's a loaded thing when talking about the entirety of everybody. But I think, you know, I think the first step is intending to have some honest assessment. And that's, you know, you got to look around in your environment. And, like, if you're getting, you know, if you're competing and you're kind of not being super successful, there's a couple ways to look at it. It's areas of improvement. And then the obvious thing, which is like, yeah, am I good enough? And not in, like, a bad way, but you just have to understand, like, if you're like a struggling to get minutes on an average varsity basketball team, you may not be a college basketball player. Obviously, per your class, per your talent, people grow at different rates. Like, there's so many variables, but I just think, like, a little bit of humility and assessment of where you are. And if you are on that line, I'd be the last person to tell you to stop competing for it. Like, compete. But you've got to take the truth to see where you've got to improve. And again, that's like I'm making something so simple, but it helps. I think you've got to watch, if you can, games of different levels to understand what it's really like. And you mentioned, like, 28,000 players, you know, 95% of them aren't going to play Division I. of course they thought that's what basketball was for them at the next level. It's what they see. It's what's on TV. It's what's on the news. It's what's, as we discussed, in their social media. That's okay. If you're not being recruited to that level at a certain point, you have to start investing maybe some time and effort into understanding what the other levels are like. And kind of like, again, I'm skipping steps a little bit, but it's like that you are what you can guard a lot of times. Well, you kind of are what your level of recruitment is. And you can believe you're better than that, and that's okay. But at a certain point, you better start assessing the level in which you're being recruited. And if you're still trying to get recruited, I think you have to understand, again, your assessment, your general physical tools and capabilities in terms of just athleticism and physicality, just the rawness of that, because there's a requisite level of that for the most part at the next level, no matter where you go. And then you know, your club situation, you know, I would say high school, but I'd be conservative here with talking about it. It's like your high school sometimes is your high school situation. Not everybody has the chance to do this, that, and the other. And within your club situation, you know, are you playing appropriate competition? And by that, I don't mean the highest. I've talked to a lot of Division I coaches, particularly in the mid to low major, that sometimes have an issue with evaluation opportunity because they want to watch a player that may be deep on a bench that is not playing, but it's a high-level floor, and so they're missing an opportunity. And I'm not allocating for that person to go change clubs or whatever. If somebody hears that, it speaks to them. But the point is, sometimes you got to make sure you're playing against appropriate comp so your game can show what it can do. So that applies to the non-Division I level too. So, like, you can't be fighting to play, you know, all Iowa Tech in a tournament or frustrated with your club if you're not getting that matchup, if that's not the level that you're trying to play. You know, if Dixon's rolling out five All-Americans, that's not the level you need to be competing with if you're fighting to be a Division II player or a Division III player or something of that nature. So I think appropriate competitive level is important. But watching the games, understanding the levels of what it really takes. If you I probably could go on and on, like, because there's no perfect answer, but like, I feel like those are the general thoughts I would start a conversation with somebody asking me, and then I think it would go into like questions of helping them break down their thought process and meeting people where they were in terms of what they do and don't know and in terms of their assessment.
Yeah, I think you hit on, like you said, 12 different topics there. We'll have to do this again because there's so much nuggets because there's so many different scenarios. And there are a lot of common scenarios. You know, you mentioned everybody wants to be on the top team. And if you're sitting on the top team, well, I mean, people, you know, may not see as much, but maybe you'll get, you know, but like you said, that situation is different. You know, I think people are having to decide between, you know, different levels. Do I, you know, play for this, you know, top team, or do I play for their secondary team? I mean, there's a lot of, you know, as the game's growing, the talent pool's growing, which is awesome. You know, that you can see the parity in our game is growing, and it'll continue to grow because the game's growing, which is awesome. But that also means that now you don't have to be on the top team on the top floor to have some opportunities. And I think there's a lot of cool stuff and good stuff there. But it was so obvious, like, you know, I mean, you are what you're recruited to. If you've got five really great D2 schools all over you and one low D1 school, I mean, that probably tells you that where you're going to have more success or more joy. And I mean, it is your journey at the end of the day. Each player, what you want to get out of it. But I think doing the homework, like you said, understanding the different levels, know what that's going to be like and what that experience is going to be like. Because, you know, there is a big difference in what goes on and how things are run, you know, at each level.
Yeah. And something I left out is you've got to kind of get with people you trust in terms of, you know, your circle and your coaching, and particularly with your club or your player development people. And you've got to see that through. You got to choose wisely and be honest about why you're choosing who you're choosing, and then see it through. It allows for some consistency through your process. And I think a lot of good coaches out there, but there's a lot of people who are selling dreams as part of their marketing, and it's not healthy and it's contributive. So that's the 13th topic we can dive into at another time.
you know, so, okay, staying with this idea of helping these guys figure this stuff out, with the growth of the game comes, you know, there's monetary opportunities for folks. And I think it's great to provide a service for people that's genuinely helpful. That, I mean, you have knowledge in it, you have knowledge, you have experience, and you can do them some good and benefit them. I think you should be paid for that, and I think that's awesome. I mean, that's life. I mean, that's business, and that's no different. But, you know, when it comes to scouting services, you know, what value do scouting services provide, and are all of them created equal? You know, I'm just kind of interested in what you think about that.
Yeah, so in terms of scouting services in the eye of players utilizing them for whatever they're utilizing for, as a consultant, as a mentor, as a development person, as kind of a marketing thing, they're certainly not all created equal, I think. I see a lot. You've got the overarching ones that I mean, I'm not going to get into brands. I honestly don't remember them. I used, you know, as a coach, years ago, you get a ton of emails, things like that. I don't necessarily believe in those. I think there are ways to have, you know, with the tools that we have with the internet and video, and things are so accessible now. There's ways for people to have, you know, a centralized like page or profile that they can share with people that helps, you know, film raw information, transcripts, these kinds of things. Just particularly at the non-division one level, where those schools don't have a lot of budgets, and it's nice for them to five clicks away from being pretty familiar with at least the player. I think there's value in that fundamentally. I think in what people pay for, I think you've got to make sure with people that have knowledge, that don't overpromise, but that they overdeliver. They've got to have familiarity with the context, with player development, with recruiting. They've got to have relationships beyond just, you know, I have so-and-so in my phone because they thought it was awkward if they didn't give me my phone number as a college coach type of thing, like actual feedback relationships. They've got to, you know, you got to be with people who understand the process of development and recruiting. You know, then the foundational elements of the clearinghouse, the timing of how, when signing happens, the likelihood of signing early versus late, and understanding the trickle down effects of now the portal and how that's changing now that there's not going to be the fifth year situation. And you've got to be with people who can consult and advise. And I feel like if you're going to pay somebody money, it should be a personal experience for sure. Yes, there's generalized advice, but the people they're dealing with should be able to talk to you, understand your situation, and be able to give personal, very specific feedback in helping that. And I've, like you said, I've got no problem with the people who do that and advise, and for the people who have the means to do that. The line for me is anybody who is insinuating that their involvement or inclusion or connection means a higher level than what's appropriate. And I think that line has to be explained and understood, that of course, like as somebody in this game, do I want you to push? Do I want you to be your best player? Yes. Does your connection to me mean that you're going to get something, you're going to get the betterment of the look? I think there's a line there that needs to be understood. And people have to be careful with the ones that promise exposure, and exposure just means video and social media and whatever, because there's a lot of that out there to digest. So to me, it doesn't necessarily mean that level up. It means it's out there, and if it hits, it hits, and if it doesn't, it doesn't, and the vast majority of it do not. And I'm not being mean when I say this, but I get tagged in stuff every single day. Every single day, that's just not applicable to what these people are aiming for. But they think it helps, and I'm not going to fault them for the hustle, right? But it's not helping, you know?
No, and it is hustle, I think, was the right word to use there. I mean, I'm going to be frank, you know, that there's not quite the diamonds in the rough that there used to be.
Correct.
We've got, I mean, this is staffs. We've got like 17 people on staff or something crazy. I mean, you know, at a high mid-major level, we've got 100 coaches, you know, that between the social media stuff, I mean, the AAU stuff, all the reports, I mean, all it, if you can play, they're going to find you.
Correct.
And, you know, like, and like you said, I think especially at the non-D1 level, there's some great value in some of those things out there. But I think that the underlying thing here and what I'm hearing from you is, you know, don't jump into something blindly. I think you gave, go back, and if you're, you know, you're a parent or you're a player trying to figure this thing out, and is this a service that can help me or benefit me, go back, hit rewind, listen to the points you made, and then ask those questions. And if they can't answer those in a really real way, I think there's probably a problem there, and you know, somebody's, you know, probably trying to make a dollar, and you know, I mean, that's there's not a business out there that somebody's not doing those things. So right. Just trying to be aware. I mean, this is a real podcast, like that.
Yeah,
this is,
yeah. You got to be careful with the guys who make a lot of I statements, and they're doing this, and their connection is to seek their self validation instead of understanding. Hey, here's how we operate. Here are the things. Let's make this about you, and then I will give you my feedback, and then my experience and my hard work will deliver, and my track record says that. That's fine. But the ones who are doing it to be part of the cool club, you got to be really careful with.
No, that's good stuff and super valuable. you know, I loved, you know, and we talked for a while. I think probably the thing that stood out the most. We talked about, you know, as people are going through visits, and that includes whatever level you're trying to get to. That's not just high major or just Division One. I mean, it's any level. And people are trying to filter out their everything. I tell recruits, you know, just about every day, college coaches aren't dumb. They're not going to call you and be like, hey, girl, our culture really sucks, but you're going to love it here. You know, I mean, everybody's putting on their best face, their best visit. That they're going to know you. They're going to know everything about you. I mean, that's their full-time job. And they're going to put on the best visit they can and tailor it to you if they're doing their job right, all these things. So how do they filter through that, and how can they make a decision that's going to be the most impactful for them long-term? And you said find someone you can fail with. Man, dig in onto that, because that's such good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you said it. I mean, these programs, and let's just zero in on the Division I level, right? Like, they've all got resources. They've all got professional staffs. They're full-time. They've got support staffs. Everybody knows that recruiting is the lifeblood of a program. So they're going to have some form of their current, you know, perfected way of presenting that. So when you got to understand the difference between, like, what is recruiting, and it's like personal and decision making and really getting in the weeds, and then like what's marketing. And a lot of recruiting is marketing. And that's fine, because first impressions matter, and then how you feel matters. You know, I think the entire, you know, industry of any business will tell you that, right? So as people are getting on campuses, they've got to just decide what they want their entire experience to be like. And from the academic end, to the 40-year plan, to the athletic part, to the development part, to the personal areas that where they need to grow. How does that resonate with the staff? Understanding you have to have a relationship with your head coach, with the assistant coaches who may or may not be there, and in some cases, a head coach who may or may not be there. There's a lot of things to take into account. But as things boil down and I have these conversations, I think one unique thing in which I've gotten feedback from talking to people when they make these calls to me, we go through a lot, and there's a, you know, 90% of it's very much the same. A question I've asked them that they've given me feedback that said they really haven't had this presented to them in this way is, I said, okay, you're imagining yourself at, let's just say you're down to two spots or whatever you're doing, you're narrowing it down. You understand going to your next level on that uphill climb. It's an incline once you get amongst the elite. So you've gone, you know, however many thousand players, you're a 1%er going to the next level, and you're going to a, let's say, a high major spot. You're a 0.0-something percenter. Your improvements are very, very incremental. It's harder than you realize. So understand, you will learn at the elite level from failing. You will learn from failure, not just your talent and you being rushed to the top of the class due to your talent and your hard work and your experiences and opportunities. But it's different when you get there. So I asked them, all right, you're joining a team. This is a big philosophy of mine. You're joining a program. Don't underestimate what you will bring to a program. But also, which environment are you going to recover from failure or fail into improvement from? Have you thought about that? What coach resonates with you in terms of how to get you to the next level? Literally, not, hey, I'm going to come here and they're going to help me get to the next level. Thank you. I heard that before on an outline, on a piece of paper from every program. No, like literally, who resonates with you in that communication? Who understands you? You know, and people connect to different people. That's fine. That's the staff is one thing. The locker room is another. And everybody presents culture and talks about culture and they overuse family and things of that nature. And that can come in a million different packages. But as you experience your time on these campuses and spend time, who do you want to be surrounded with? Because you will fail. So understand that. And then who do you want to be around when it gets tough? The locker room that bitches and points fingers and blames or gets manipulative, or the one that's like, hey, this is part of it. If we actually want to be good, we need to lean into the fact that coach challenged us today or threw us a curveball in practice or whatever. Have you thought about being around the people that are mature enough to be modeling the behavior and the philosophies of things that you aspire to be? Because like, have you thought about what environment you want to be in when you get to campus and get your ass kicked? And they're like, wow, I've never thought about it like that. And like, I don't think it's like, you know, I'm sure it's been presented other ways, but in my experience, I've gotten positive feedback and appreciation because they're like, okay, that's made me look at this from a more mature standpoint. And I've never really thought about failing because my recruiting has all been about how successful I'm going to be. And some of them do respond. They're like, yeah, you know, I've been talking to coach about areas I need to get better in, but I want to dive deeper into really putting myself in that spot. And the diamonds are in the details. It's in the nuance. And this is one of them that I just kind of say like, all right, here's something to think about. Chew on that for whatever that's worth.
No, great stuff. Great stuff. And I think that goes for coaches, people in the professional, you know, world and everything else. So I think that's some really valuable insight.
Thank you.
Jane, we're going to move on to our quick hitter segment. This segment is all about just hitting on a couple quick topics outside of, you know, outside of maybe someone's wheelhouse, but still, you know, things that are interesting going on in the hoops landscape. So I'm going to play a short clip here from Gino talking about the student athlete welfare, the mm-hmm. NIL piece. And amateurism and what all that looks like today, and then really interested to get your thoughts on that.
The test for, do we keep the charade of student athlete and amateurism, or do we call it what it is, you know, semi-professional, pay-for-play sports? So either keep the charade of student athlete, teams wouldn't be going 3,000 miles to play conference games if it had anything to do with student athlete welfare. That's number one. So let's just call it what it is. We're going to pay these guys to play basketball or play football or pay them to play, you know, any sport at a university. And then let's make it a business and figure out how do we manage this business. Other sports have done it. Pro sports, they've done it. They sign kids to contracts, and you're bound to your contract. And let's honor the terms of the contract. Let's do it. You already got kids holding out. Right, you already got guys playing and going, I ain't playing anymore until I get more money. So we become professional sports. Let's say it and let's act it. Right? And let's stop the charade. The portal, how about we teach kids how to make a commitment and stick to it? All right, I get it, you want to leave. Fine, leave, no penalties. How many times do you get a chance to leave? No penalties. Coach can leave anytime he wants. I can, I have a buyout. That's a great idea. Let's sign kids to a contract and let's put a buyout in. Let's make it a business, because that's exactly what it is. That would fix it. And let's have a salary cap, which I think this 20%, you know, whatever it is, I think that's what it is, right? So they're getting close, but they got to start calling it what it really is and not be ashamed of it, right? The kids aren't ashamed of it. Hey, are you student athlete? You an amateur? Yeah, I am, but you get paid a lot of money. I know. Let's not talk about that, but I like it.
All right, so there's some pretty interesting, you know, heavy hitting stuff in there, man. What do you think about that?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you know, Coach Ariyama been around a long time, and then, you know, certainly is never short of a thought or an opinion, and it generally has some wisdom behind it, without question, right? And some humor a lot of times. So it's always fun to listen to. But, you know, I'm of the opinion as things got changed and I guess a simple way to say it is like deregulated in terms of NIL and things like that. One of the first complaints I had was like, okay, there's a difference between NIL and collective, and that to me has to be defined. And in terms of what Coach Ariyama is talking about, we are at the point, let's call it what it is. It's a semi-professional thing. Each of these players now at the Division I level in particular is at least a potential small business. There's a level of education that goes into that from a financial responsibility and maximization standpoint. And then right now it's a little bit of a free-for-all in terms of interpretation and the way things are going due to, like, again, name, image, likeness, which was like the intent, which is like, if a business wants me to promote them, I should be able, like any regular student, to enter into a business agreement. And then there's the collective bit, which we've seen, you know, different versions of. A few bucks here or there for an appearance to a, you know, a Lamborghini lease if you play for Texas football or something, right? I think what you want in anything, like even at professional levels with salary caps or different rules, you want a professional, a competitive balance, and then you want people to be protected on both ends. So I think there needs to be a freedom of contractual agreements, what's agreed to, what it means. I had an interview yesterday with an opportunity. I received their offer, and I'm going to review that and decide and ask a few questions, right? Like, that's how that works. That's how job offers work. That's how, you know, pay for work or production works. You define it. So I think we have to get there. I think the more regulation we have for competitive balance, not more regulation as in like bureaucratic, but regulation as in existing, is important. And each program needs to know, each conference needs to know, each level needs to know, whether we get to this super league or whatever we're getting to, needs to know what they're operating in, and then go do your work from there. And it's a little undefined. From what I understand, I think we expect more of a ruling or an understanding to come in April. But yeah, I think the protection of the players, the expectation, I believe in defining things black and white. And if you're going to be a small business, just like anything else, there's the litany of things that come with that responsibility. And it's another opportunity to grow them and also protect the program and protect the player. And talking to agents and parents and players and all of the above, there's a lot of things undefined. There's a lot of things people are waiting on. And there's a lot of nonsense going on. And yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much, you know, I'm not saying I could walk in the meeting and lay down the structure, but I'm in agreement of the sentiment for sure.
Yeah, it's a tough conversation and one, you know, needs to be had. So, no, that's good stuff. Next quick hitter here. If you could change any rule in women's college basketball, what would it be? Or do you just love them? You love them all?
I mean, you know, I'd almost want to flip the script and ask you, like, as a coach, what are things that you guys decide? On a bigger level, I'm always, particularly having spent time there at that level, like, I've always thought about, like, the discussion of the value or what the argument would be. I think the conference champion in low to mid-major conferences should get the bid. I'd like the conference tournament. I think I would like to there to be some more weight if somebody makes a run there in consideration for like picking spots at the end versus like, you know, the 500 P5 group that, you know, has a resume but some excuses too. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know if that's, I might be circumventing your question. It's not really a rule, but it's like a philosophy, you know? I'd be interested to know if like there were specific rules that you guys discuss. I was thinking more game rules, like recruiting rules and all that kind of stuff. I don't, that's too much for me. I don't even want to mess with it. But like, I'd be curious what you guys think about.
This is super specific, and I'm sure I'm the only idiot out here willing to die on this hill, but if there's a jump ball with 8 seconds on the, like 2 seconds on the clock, and it's your possession and you had the ball, it stays at 2 seconds. Like, you get penalized. Like, it should go back to 10 or 15 if it's under 10 or 15 and it's a jump ball, because it's, I mean, it just kills your possession, you know? So I don't even know that anyone's thought that much. I mean, it happens, you know, once or twice every other couple games, but I can't wrap my head around why, if it's a jump ball and it's their ball, they get it fresh clock. If it's a jump ball and it was our ball and there's 2 seconds, why is it still 2 seconds? Why can't I get, you know, like, I've lost the possession arrow. So yeah, at least give me the true possession.
Yeah. Or at least the half reset, right? The FIBA reset. Because you can argue if it was a jump ball, they possessed the ball. So if there had been a change of possession, to me as a defender, if you could define change of possession, if you then tied it up, theoretically that should be a reset, right? So like, I'm with you there. I'm with you there.
All right, we'll see if we
that's very discussable.
All right, we'll see if we can push that through. I'm sure all the rules makers are going to be all tuned in here.
Yeah.
All right, last little quick hitter we got for you. When you were recruiting coordinator, what's something outside of the obvious and the immediate that jumped off the page? It's not hard to see, you know, when you think about a couple of the recruits that you landed that, you know, weren't, you know, that the top high-end obvious recruits, what was it about them that stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're working at the different levels, like, yeah, you don't always get, like, your, you know, the same pick of the litter as you know, Don and Gino and Kim and Tara and all these guys. So like, yeah, you're looking for, obviously, like, the things that stood out was like, yeah, like the combination of the potential, the maturity, the competitiveness, some projecting that different ways for how it applies to your program, is different for everybody. So like how they talk the game, things that they can tell you that they took away from their experiences with you or visits. It's like an imperfect, unwritten down recipe. Sometimes you just got to like go with like how that fits you and how they fit. And you get a feel for that over time. Now, just observing, like from a simpler answer, like, yeah, like sometimes you can just tell, like, this person carries themselves like a hooper. And like, if you've been in this for a long time, you just know, you're like, they care. There's a hooper quality about them. I think in our community, in our society, I call it basketball soul. Like, you can sense people who are like, I bring values of the game to my life. Again, it's a whole nother conversation. There's been a great book written on it by David Hollander out of NYU. Like, values of the game to your life, resonating with those people, wanting them in your locker room. Like, those were particularly outstanding to me.
That's good stuff. That's really good. All right, man. Time for the last segment of the show. We're going to throw the full court press on you.
All right.
These are going to be short questions, but you've only got 10 seconds or less to get it across. All right.
Yeah, got it.
All right. Here we go. Do you think they should expand the NCAA tournament field?
No.
Okay. Like, give me one podcast, one Twitter follow that anyone that loves basketball should know about.
Twitter follow, Mark Schindler, MG_Schindler. The guy dives in and is so granular. And he's so passionate, and at multiple levels, it's fantastic. And then the podcast it's not a basketball podcast, but I believe that basketball has an art element to it and a thinking element to it. And so I'd say right now, something that I don't miss is Tetragrammaton by Rick Rubin. His book is fantastic, and it helps you think in a way that's very applicable to basketball. In my opinion, he talks to a lot of people about their process and their passions, and I think it's applicable to the art of basketball.
Awesome. Good stuff. All right. Last one here. All right. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what current NCAA women's basketball player would you absolutely not want to play one-on-one? She would destroy you, embarrass you. You'd have to go into hiding.
Oh, wow. That's a lot to admit.
We said we're vulnerable today.
No, 100%. I'm just joking. Man, I don't think I want Hannah Hidalgo guarding me. She pops in my head. I don't think I don't think I want to guard Reagan Beers, but I don't think today, putting a ball in my hands, that I want Hannah Hidalgo checking me. Like, I don't think I want that.
Nah, that's a lot of zigzags before you get to half court. I don't think I want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
No, hey, that's awesome stuff, man. Seriously, Shane, thanks for coming on, sharing the game, sharing some knowledge, and just really appreciate it, and be excited to follow along with what you do and how you keep growing the women's basketball space.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's a great conversation. I'm sure we could go on, as we have in our phone conversations, for a long time. It's very valuable. It's great that you're doing it. I hope the audience grows, and I'm sure I look forward to listening to the coaches you have on. We've talked about some of your future guests, so pleasure is mine. Very grateful.
All right, till next time. At the Buzz with some final thoughts. I hope you enjoyed Shane's insights and information. He truly is one of the great guys doing this, and the work he does for women's basketball does not go unnoticed. So make sure and plug in and stay updated with everything he's got going on. For the fans of women's basketball, at any level really, some of the best coverage you can find is the World Exposure Report on Twitter. The World Exposure Report puts out great content ranging from JUCO basketball to the WNBA to Division I and anything in between. There's information on recruiting, rankings, what's going on day-to-day in the women's basketball landscape, and much more. Just wanted to give a shout-out there. I appreciate anybody that's helping grow our space in those ways. Make sure and give that account a follow. But that's all we got for you in this episode. So if you enjoyed it, make sure and like, subscribe, hit that retweet button, help us out, help spread the word. Make sure to tune in when we drop our next episode at 8 a.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday. Until then, keep adding your playbook.